Hello, everybody. This is Don Weber in Chicago. We decided we'll try to start right at 6:30 so that everybody knows that and we can finish on time. But I want to just welcome everybody. Several are from our experience last year, the series we did then. So welcome back to them. And there's a number of new participants. So we want to offer a special welcome as you join our group tonight. We're glad to have you with us. So Paul of the Cross wrote once, "In daily meditation of the Passion of Jesus Christ, you will learn charity, patience, mildness towards others." And that, in a way, he's talking about how he gazed upon the face of Jesus Christ. So we're happy to have Robin help us do that today in today's world so that we draw closer to Jesus crucified.
So Robin last year did two sessions with us. He was one of our more popular presenters, and it's good to have him back this time. We welcome you, Robin, as we start looking a little bit deeper beyond Scripture into the topics of Christology. So, Robin, I'm going to turn it over to you. You're going to need to, Robin, you're going to need to unmute.
Be after this, you'll wish that I was muted the whole time. So, good evening, everybody. Again, welcome, a warm welcome to all of you. It's great to be with you and people from all over the world. So it's wonderful to have this opportunity. In that reading that I provided for David for on the website, on the portal, I took it from a little section of my little book, Gazing on His Face, which talks about Jesus under different images and titles and our relationship with him. The first chapter is Christ, Our Friend. It's not going to be the focus of my presentation tonight, but it might be helpful to you to think about a title or an image of Jesus that's been particularly formative for you in your own faith life and spiritual life. I'm very conscious tonight of Donald Sr., Father Donald Sr., who's rehabbing after a long stay in the hospital. I'm going to quote Don several times in this presentation, so let's keep him in our thoughts and prayers as we reflect on Christology tonight. So I'm supposed to do all of Christology in about 55 minutes, which is impossible. I don't want to go over the time and get a 15-yard penalty from David and Don. That wouldn't be good. So I'm going to do the best I can. What I want to do is three things. I want to reflect a little bit on the portraits of Jesus in the letters of Paul and the four Gospels first. Secondly, say a few words about the development of Christology in the early church. And thirdly, mention four developments in modern thought about Jesus. So those are my goals. We'll see how long that takes. Let me share the screen here and give you an outline. It's kind of a dull, less than scintillating outline, but it'll help you follow the presentation nonetheless. Where did it go? There it is. Okay. So first, let's reflect on some of the New Testament portraits of Jesus. You know, a rudimentary form of Christology began ever since the public activity of Jesus caused people to wonder who he was and what he's all about. Last year, Don Sr. provided us with a very cogent presentation of how the Gospels came to be formed, the formation of the Gospels. We know that they're written as confessional documents, statements of faith, by authors looking back on Jesus' life through the lens of the Easter experience. But there's a real historical core there. And they show that Jesus' disciples were trying to figure out who he was as they walked along with him. You can get that from the Gospels. Edward Skillebeck, a famous theologian who wrote massive works on Christology, liked to say, it all began with an encounter. It all began with an encounter. Encounters with Jesus by many different kinds of people in diverse settings. The Gospel narratives show us that these encounters elicited various reactions from people and led them to wonder who this Jesus of Nazareth really was. As you know, each New Testament author writes from his own perspective on Jesus, so there's a diversity among New Testament Christologies, though not an uncontrolled diversity. Let me just trace some of the main features of the Christologies of Paul and the four Gospels. So beginning with Paul, Paul, of course, wrote letters, not theological treatises, letters addressed to different Christian communities in the Mediterranean world. Paul's letters have a profoundly occasional quality to them. They're written under specific circumstances and address particular issues within the communities to which he was writing. Paul sees himself as a preacher and a pastor. So one has to glean his Christology from these letters, find out what the story of Jesus is underneath these letters. He continued to reflect on that, and it seems that his Christology developed over time. There's no evidence of him having known Jesus during Jesus' public ministry, but his experience of an encounter with the risen Jesus on the road to Damascus certainly formed him. The distinguished New Testament scholar Joseph Fitzmyer, whose name is on the handout there, identified three effects of that experience on the road to Damascus, three effects of that transformative experience. First, he said, it convinced Paul of the unity of God's action for the salvation of all humanity. He came to believe that the one God who had entered into covenant with Israel had acted in a new and definitive way in Jesus. This was the same God that Paul had served as a devout Jew. So Paul begins to view Christ as the climax of Israel's history. Secondly, that experience convinced Paul of the salvific value of Jesus' death and resurrection, so he could come to speak of the wisdom of the cross in 1 Corinthians, a phrase, of course, that's very dear to us passionists. Paul's encounter with the risen Christ convinced him of the saving value of Jesus' death in a way he never would have suspected before. Crucifixion was the worst kind of death. It was crazy to think of a savior, a Messiah, being crucified. As Don Sr. said in a lecture, from a hated and feared symbol of death, the cross was transformed into a sign of unconditional love and abundant life. And thirdly, that Damascus Road experience gave Paul a new vision of history. Before his encounter with Jesus, Paul would have envisioned three periods of history: the time before the law, before the Torah; secondly, the time from Moses with the Torah in the present; and the third, the Messianic age, when the Torah would be fulfilled in the future. Well, his experience of the risen Christ convinced him that in Jesus, the Messianic age had already begun. It had begun, though he still looked forward to the culmination of this age with the return of Christ. One Pauline conception that became important for the Christology of the early church was developed especially by Irenaeus of Lyon, who was the most important Christian theologian of the second century. It's evident this is the notion of Jesus as the new Adam, or the second Adam. It's evident in Romans chapter 5 and 1 Corinthians chapter 15, and to some extent in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. This is connected with Paul's conviction that the resurrection of Jesus is the beginning of the general resurrection of the dead. Christ raised from the dead is the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep, Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 15. This notion of Jesus as the new Adam leads to Paul's talk about a new creation in Christ. The obedience of Jesus, the second Adam, overcomes the disobedience of the first Adam, which had unleashed the powers of sin and death. Death came through the first Adam. The beginning of freedom from the power of death comes through Christ's resurrection. In other words, the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus gives a fresh start for the human race. The human race gets a fresh start. A few words about the Gospel of Mark. Most scholars, as you probably know, assert that the Gospel of Mark was the first of the Gospels to be written. Mark then was the first to combine the disparate oral and written sources of the Jesus tradition into one continuous narrative. The tenor of suffering for the faith permeates this gospel, leading many to argue that it was addressed to a Christian community in Rome that had been severely persecuted under Nero in the mid-60s of the first century. Other scholars argue for a location closer to Palestine during the time of the first Jewish revolt against the Romans, 66 to 70, but it seems that the majority place this context for this gospel in Rome. But whatever the precise location, it seems that Mark's Christians knew suffering and upheaval firsthand, and even the realities of failure and betrayal. They had been exposed to the pain and tragedy of human history. The shadow of the cross then looms large over the entire gospel. This is evident in a sort of ironic twist in Mark's passion narrative, where the one human being who makes the most correct affirmation of Jesus' identity in the gospel is the centurion, the soldier who's part of the execution squad. Mark writes that seeing how Jesus breathed his last, seeing how Jesus died, the centurion said, "Truly this man was the Son of God." For Mark, then, the centurion can utter this Christological confession because he saw the way that Jesus died. The true identity of Jesus can only be known in the shadow of the cross. This gospel interweaves Christology and discipleship. Coming to know who Jesus really is and coming to know what it means to follow him go hand in hand. You come to know him in the following. Mark's idea of discipleship is capsulized in chapter 3, verses 14 to 15, which isn't on your handout. It should be. When Mark writes, "Jesus appointed 12, whom he also named apostles, that they might be with him and he might send them forth to preach and to have authority to drive out demons." So to be a disciple of Jesus means first being with him, walking with him, and second, sharing his mission of announcing the gospel and bringing life to people. The famous New Testament scholar Raymond Brown, about whom Don Sr. wrote a biography, he made at once an intriguing remark about the Christology of the four Gospels. He said that in each of the Gospels, there's an inherent tension between portraying Jesus' exalted status on the one hand and his lowly service on the other hand. And each Gospel writer handles that tension differently. All of the Gospels present a Jesus who was clearly the Messiah, the Son of Man, the Son of God, during his earthly life. We hear that in the very first verse of Mark's Gospel, the beginning of the Gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Yet each of the Gospels treats differently this tension between the exalted status, the exalted Messiah, and the lowly servant. You might think of a spectrum here, with Mark at one end and John at the other, and Matthew and Luke in the middle. Mark preserves the greatest amount of lowliness by describing a ministry in which no human being, until the centurion, acknowledges Jesus' divine sonship. The demons know it, and the reader knows it. The reader is told about it at Jesus' baptism, but not those who encounter him within this story. So in the first half of Mark's gospel, Jesus is the herald of the reign of God. He proclaims the coming of God's rule, and he makes the kingdom present in fragmentary ways in and through his encounters with people. Think of his encounter with the leper in the first chapter of Mark's gospel. Jesus is moved with pity, it says, at the sight of the leper coming and asking for healing. It's a Greek word that means his guts are turned inside out at this sight of the leper. And he does the unthinkable in reaching out to touch the leper. He bridges the gap between the holy and the unclean. That's where the kingdom is becoming present, right there. In this proclamation of the kingdom, then, God is acting in a decisive way, drawing close to God's people in and through the actions, words, and the very person of Jesus. So in the first half of the gospel, up to about chapter 8, where Peter makes his great confession of faith, Jesus is the herald of the kingdom. In the second half of the gospel, after Peter's confession of Jesus as the Messiah, Jesus is depicted as the Messiah whose destiny is the fate of the Son of Man. The very intriguing phrase, the Son of Man. Here the gospel redefines what it means to be the Messiah in terms of suffering, death, and resurrection. Jesus will not be the royal Messiah who vanquishes his foes in this age. He will be the Messiah who fulfills his mission as the Son of Man who gives his life for the many. In his commentaries on the Passion narratives, which are very good to read, Don Sr. has remarked that Mark's account of the Passion is the most stark of the four Gospels. At his betrayal in the garden, Mark tells us that they all left him and fled. They all left him in flood. Jesus is completely bereft at his arrest. And his description and Mark's description of the instant of death of Jesus is raw and stunning. As Jesus cries out the opening words of Psalm 22, my God, why have you forsaken me? And he dies with a loud scream in Greek. Yet at the moment of the complete giving of his life, the curtain of the temple is torn in two, indicating that all people have access to God. And the Roman soldier makes his proclamation, truly this man was the Son of God. Mark's account of the Passion is rather bare bones. Most scholars think that the original gospel ended at chapter 16, verse 8, though verses 9 through 20 are part of the canonical gospel. But in these first verses of chapter 16, the angel proclaims to the women who come to the tomb early in the morning that Jesus has been raised up. They're to go to Galilee and tell his brothers. There they will see the risen Christ. The women react with trembling and bewilderment and say nothing to anyone. As Don Sr. puts it, the beginnings of the church in Mark are not triumphant or heroic. The community is back on the road with Jesus, following along behind him. How does Matthew present his portrait of Jesus? Matthew's gospel was read today for the first chapter for the Feast of the Birth of Mary. The author of the Gospel of Matthew depended on Mark's gospel and on a source of Jesus' sayings that he shared with Luke, as well as some distinctive traditions of his own. Many scholars see Matthew as a Jewish Christian who was writing for a community, an important part of which was closely related to Judaism. This gospel is usually dated in the 80s and often associated with Antioch in Syria. Antioch in Syria was the third largest city in the Roman Empire. It had important communities of Jews and of Christians there. You can feel tension in this gospel, both within Matthew's community and between the Christian community and the Jewish community in Antioch. Don Sr. describes Matthew's community as immersed in a critical transition moment. Once a strongly Jewish Christian community, it was fast becoming increasingly Gentile in composition. It was suffering a wrenching separation from its roots in Judaism, and it was faced with the prospect of growing numbers of Gentile Christians, on the other hand. It appears that Matthew wants to reassure his own Christian community that in following Jesus, they're being faithful to their Jewish heritage. Matthew does that in different ways. One way is a series of fulfillment quotations with ample use of the term fulfill, plerosai in Greek. For example, after he recounts the annunciation of Jesus' birth to Joseph, which we heard in today's gospel reading, he quotes the Greek version of Isaiah 7:14. Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. The young woman, pregnant and about to bear a son, shall name him Emmanuel. Another way he does this is by using the title Son of David, much more than Mark did, for example. This title is closely related to that of Messiah, and it's applied to Jesus, especially in his healing ministry. Matthew makes it clear that Jesus, the Son of David, is not the powerful warrior Messiah whom some expected. When Matthew describes the ministry of Jesus, he quotes Isaiah 42, a bruised reed he will not break, a smoldering wick he will not quench. There's also the use of Moses typology in the gospel. In a sense, Jesus is like the new Moses. So when Jesus, the one male child, escapes the clutches of Herod in the infancy narratives as his parents flee to Egypt, that's reminiscent of the birth of Moses and his being saved from the clutches of Pharaoh. And finally, the most important Christological title in this gospel seems to be Jesus as the Son of God. Now, Matthew doesn't offer systematic theological reflection on the nature of Jesus' sonship. He simply presents Jesus as the perfectly obedient son who has a unique relationship with God and acts with definitive authority. Later on, in the early centuries of the church, what it means for him to be son of God will have to be thought about and analyzed. On that spectrum of Brown, of gospel presentations of Jesus' exalted status and his lowly servanthood, Matthew's presentation of Jesus in his earthly ministry is more exalted than that of Mark. He allows the exalted status of Jesus to break through the lowliness so that on certain occasions his disciples recognize who he is. So, for example, the story of the calming of the sea when the disciples are in the boat being rocked about and Jesus comes and calms, it is I, do not be afraid. In Mark's version of that, Mark tells us that the disciples were completely astounded and did not understand. Their hearts were hardened. In the Gospel of Matthew, though, the disciples do homage to Jesus, and they confess, "Truly you are the Son of God." Jesus' exalted status has broken through, and he is recognized, his divinity is recognized. The Gospel of Luke. The author of the Gospel of Luke and the Acts of the Apostles, the same author, of course, also drew on Mark's Gospel, on that same source that he shared with Matthew, and some very distinctive traditions about Jesus and about the church. Writing probably in the 80s of the first century, he presented a proclamation of the Gospel in two volumes, Gospel and Acts. So Luke's Christology is, for example, also articulated in important speeches by Peter and Paul in Acts. The Gospel appears to have been written for a mostly Gentile audience. The author has a good grasp of Greek and may have been a Gentile, possibly a Gentile convert to Judaism, who later became a Christian. That may have been the case. It's be interesting if it was. So as in Matthew, so in Luke, the dynamic of promise and fulfillment is evident, though in a less stylized way than Matthew's fulfillment quotations. Luke wants to assure his readers that God is faithful. God keeps his promises, but he does that often in unexpected ways, in ways that include Gentiles, the unclean, the poor, women, rich toll collectors, and other outcasts. Of course, Luke's the gospel we're hearing this year on most Sundays. This Sunday, it'll be the chapter 15, the three parables of mercy. The three canticles that are prayed each day in the Christian liturgy of the hours, Canticle of Zechariah, the Canticle of Mary, and of Simeon, are all drawn from Luke's gospel. And if you look at them carefully, they reflect this theme of promise and fulfillment. Luke is also well known and popular among many Christians for his portrayal of Jesus' mission as one of compassion. Great Italian poet Dante called Luke the scribe of Christ's gentleness. Scribe of Christ's gentleness. Distinguished scripture scholar Raymond Brown said that more than any other evangelist, Luke has given the world a Jesus to love. Some of the most famous gospel stories and scenes are found only in Luke's gospel. The story of the Good Samaritan, the healing of the woman bent double, the parable of the prodigal son, which we'll hear this Sunday, Jesus' forgiveness of the good thief. In general, Luke also presents a more exalted picture of Jesus than that found in Mark. Just one example. The final words of the dying Jesus are not the opening verse of Psalm 22, as in Mark and Matthew, but words taken from Psalm 31, which was the evening prayer of the pious Jew. Into your hands I commend my spirit. That phrase, of course, is continued today in that night prayer for the Christian liturgy of the hours. Into your hands I commend my spirit. So the noble Luke and Jesus is at peace with God and himself. The noble Luke and Jesus is at peace with God and himself. Luke also wants to reassure his readers that the risen Jesus is ever present to his community. It's interesting that Luke narrates Jesus' ascension twice, at the end of the gospel and the beginning of Acts. When you think of ascension, our image probably is like the space shuttle taking off from Cape Kennedy in Florida, going up to the sky. But Luke doesn't want to communicate that idea. He doesn't want to communicate Jesus' absence. He wants to proclaim the active presence of the risen Jesus in the life of the community. He does it in the gospel and in the Acts. So, for example, in the famous Emmaus story that we know well from Luke 24, where the risen Jesus walks along with the two distraught disciples, helping them to discern the meaning of all that has taken place. It's also evident in Acts, where Luke tells us in different ways how the active presence of the risen Jesus continues in the affairs of the church. One famous example, which I've already mentioned, Paul's life-changing encounter with the risen Lord. So in Acts, the risen Christ is the church's best executive recruiter. He's the best executive recruiter for the church. The Gospel of John. As I'm sure you probably know, the Gospel of John is distinctive when compared with Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It's distinctive in structure, in tone, and in content. This gospel presents Jesus as one who is conscious of having pre-existed with the Father before he came into the world. This perspective is spelled out poetically in the prologue to the gospel, which serves as a kind of overture to the whole gospel. It's like the overture of a symphony, announcing the themes that will be developed in the symphony. That's what the prologue does in John's gospel. Prologue begins in the beginning, reflecting the words of Genesis in the story of creation. So a new creation has taken place or is taking place. It identifies Jesus as the Logos or Word of God, who was with God and was God. Further along in the prologue, we find the most explicit, though not the only one, but the most explicit statement of belief in the incarnation in the whole New Testament. And the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. This affirmation of the incarnation of God in Jesus is the guiding vision, sort of the governing perspective for all that takes place in the gospel. There's a lot of debate among scholars about the authorship of this gospel and the complex history of the community in which it was written and for which it was written. It seems to have been a sad history of that community with real divisions and splits and schisms, really. The hero of this community is the beloved disciple, who may or may not be identical with the Apostle John, probably not, and probably did not write the gospel. It appears that this community experienced significant transition and internal divisions. There are also indications of the tension with the synagogue, and the phrase "the Jews" is employed as a symbolic category for all those who refuse to believe in Jesus. The prevalence of this phrase has had tragic consequences for Christian attitudes toward our Jewish sisters and brothers, and still today is not adequately explained by Christian preachers to their congregation. Preachers ought to explain what it means when we read those passages about the Jews. Otherwise, it plays into anti-Semitism. A lot could be said about this gospel and the three letters of John in the New Testament, which seem to come from the same community. But suffice it to say that there's a stress on the exalted status of Jesus throughout the gospel, often labeled as a Christology from above, starting from God in eternity, coming to earth. So, for example, in the gospel, already in the second chapter, there's no transfiguration scene in John's gospel, because the glory of Jesus is already evident in the second chapter of the story of Cana and the water and the wine at Cana in Galilee, the wedding feast. And Jesus presents himself throughout as the very revelation of the Father. He is both revealer and revelation. When you read the passion narrative in John's gospel, there's this constant going back and forth. Pilate takes Jesus into the praetorium and questions him. Then they come out to the crowd, then back into the praetorium and back. And when you read it, it's really like Pilate is on trial, not Jesus. Jesus is in control and Pilate's on trial. In chapter 19, verse 9 in John's gospel, Pilate asks the key question for the gospel. Where are you from? Where are you from? The question of origins. That's the question that the reader must reflect on for reading the gospel. Pilate never really understands. He's dense. He doesn't get the answer. But that's the key question, that Jesus' origins are from God, not from below. That's John's perspective. And the cross is envisioned as the hour of glory, of course. Jesus' last words before his death are, "It is finished. Mission accomplished." As Don Sr. puts it, Jesus dies with majestic assurance. You know, it's always intrigued me, especially as a passionist reading the Gospels. You have these four Gospels, and Matthew and Mark, Jesus' last words are, my God, why have you forsaken me? In Mark, they're more stark in the Greek than in Matthew. In Luke, you have, into your hands I commend my spirit. And in John, you have, it is finished. Different portrayals of Jesus in his death. But it's interesting because people die differently, don't they? Some people fight against death all the way to the end. Death is the enemy to be overcome, and it's a battle all the way. Other people, perhaps fewer in number, but are able to come to some sense of acceptance of their mortality and death. They're more like the Lucan Jesus. A few people, probably few in number, almost see death as a kind of triumph and a homecoming. If we only had one gospel, we'd only have one portrayal of this. But because we have these different portrayals of Jesus' death in the gospels, it's telling us that each way of dying can be a dying with Christ. Each way of dying can be a dying holding on to the hand of Christ. Different people relate to different ways that the gospel speak of Jesus' death. An important ingredient of the Gospel of John is the use of various symbols to articulate something of the richness of the mystery of Jesus. We know them well. Jesus as living water in chapter 4, as bread of life in chapter 6, true light of the world, chapter 9, good shepherd, chapter 10, true vine, chapter 15. These symbols in different ways illumine something of the true identity of Jesus, something of the mystery. Especially showing that he's the source of life for everyone. Think of the vine and the branches. Jesus is the source of life. You can't take apart the vine from the branches from the vine. And these statements culminate in a few verses in the gospel where Jesus simply says, I am, which is a clear reference to divinity. I am without any predicate. I am. One more feature of the Gospel of John pointed out by Raymond Brown. You know, Jesus is remembered in all the Gospels as a person of extraordinary authority, a person endowed with the power of God. In fact, the word used for miracle in the synoptics is often dynamis, from which we get our word dynamite, deeds of power. When Jesus heals a leper, it's a deed of power. So he's known as this person with special divine authority and power. But he's also remembered as one who exhibited love in what he did, and was deeply loved by those who followed him. Brown points out that the Gospel of John makes it clear that a loving relationship with Jesus remains an intrinsic necessity within the church. This is related to the contemplative tone of the Gospel. John's Gospel has a contemplative tone to it. People are gazing at Jesus in a sense. The Gospel, John Brown says, reminds us that church membership is not a sufficient goal. It's not enough to get people on the rolls of the church, give them those Sunday envelopes to put in the basket. That the church must lead people into a living, close, intimate relationship with Jesus. If it only focuses on church membership, it's not doing its job. It must go further than that, helping initiate people into an experience of Jesus. So those are just a few words about the letters of Paul and the four Gospels, which are inadequate, I know, but it's the best we can do tonight. Let's say a few words about Christological developments in the early church. Okay. There we are. The first 5 centuries of the church were a period of intense Christological reflection and debate, intense discussion. It was a time of the expansion of the church into the larger Greco-Roman world, what we call today enculturation, enculturating the gospel in the larger Gentile Greco-Roman world, the Greek world, Greek thought. Also a time at the beginning of this period, at least, of intermittent persecution, at least until Constantine came to power in the early 4th century. This movement outward into the Greco-Roman world compelled theologians to translate the biblical witness about Jesus into terms and conceptual categories intelligible in that wider Hellenistic culture. It wasn't that everyone in the Mediterranean world was a philosopher, but they were brought up in breathing the air, part of their culture of Aristotle and Plato and all those other Plotinus. And so that was the way people thought. Well, how do you translate good news from Jesus that's rooted in Judaism and Israel out to this larger world? What terms do we use? And often these debates had to do with terminology. What's the right term to use to describe Jesus? And sometimes the different sides didn't understand what the other was saying in the different terms they used. because the biblical testimony about Jesus is diverse, as we've seen, there was diversity of opinion regarding how to speak of the identity of Jesus, especially his relationship with God. If you've ever been part of a Bible study group, you know that people can read the same text and come up with different interpretations of it, right? Well, that was happening in the early church too. All parties were striving to be faithful to the scriptures. The thinkers could appeal to different New Testament statements by and about Jesus, come to divergent interpretations. For example, if you take John's gospel in chapter 10, verse 30, Jesus says, "The Father and I are one." Four chapters later, in chapter 14, Jesus says, "The Father is greater than I." What do you do with that? How do you interpret that? You know, these debates were carried on by believers who participated in the church's liturgical prayer, the church's worship prayer. There's the oft-quoted theological axiom, which is on your handout, lex orandi, lex credendi. The law of praying is the law of believing, or better put, the prayer of the church influences the doctrine of the church, and vice versa. So, for example, when Christian worshipers acclaim Jesus as divine, for example, when they say Jesus is Lord, Jesus is Kyrios. Kyrios was a Greek word used for the divine. When they said that or prayed that in their liturgy or sang that, they had to ask themselves, what are we saying? What are we saying about Jesus? What is our prayer saying about Jesus? What are we affirming here? There were four church councils held between 325 and 451 that really became foundational for Christian doctrine about Jesus, a couple after that too, but especially these four. The Council of Nicaea in 325, the First Council of Constantinople in 381, Council of Ephesus in 431, which is a particularly conflictual council. They brought in the troops in that one. And the Council of Chalcedon, sometimes pronounced Chalcedon, in 451. Let me just say a few words about Nicaea and Chalcedon, or Chalcedon. The Council of Nicaea was occasioned by the teaching of Arius. Whoops, I'm behind in the scrolling, and that's another 15-yard penalty. The Council of Nicaea was occasioned by the teaching of Arius, an older respected priest from Alexandria. Alexandria in Egypt was a center of both Jewish and Christian learning, great thinkers there. The debate that his teaching ignited focused on Christian understanding of the divinity of Jesus. How divine is the Son, or the Word? How divine is the Son? How is divine is the one who became flesh in Jesus? The interpretation of Proverbs chapter 8, a passage about personified wisdom, became central to the debate. Arius spoke of the Son, or the Word, as a creature, certainly the highest and most perfect creature, unlike other creatures, but a creature nonetheless. There was the famous Arian slogan, "There was when he was not." There was when he was not. For Arius, the Son is a kind of demigod, a half-god, who is not co-eternal with the highest God or the Father. Now, this is based on certain assumptions. Arius wasn't just trying to be difficult, although he was difficult, but he wasn't just trying to be difficult. Two presuppositions. One is God's utter transcendence. God can't traffic with this world. God remains distant from this world because God is utterly transcendent. So if you speak of the incarnation, God and the Word became flesh, that Word or that Son can't be the highest God, because God could never get messed up in the muck and mire of this world. Shows you how radical the teaching of the incarnation really is. And also, it had to do with Arius' attempt to deal with the cross, the passion and the cross. It was the philosophical principle, the divine is impassible. The divine is immune from suffering. If you say that Jesus is divine and he suffered on the cross, he couldn't have been completely divine in the highest sense. So in Arius' system, a lesser semi-divine being, the Son, suffers for the highest God, who remains distant from suffering. Again, this question, you know, we're passionists here. This question of the cross and suffering was a particularly urgent one, how to deal with that in the early church and its doctrinal debates. So the Council of Nicaea responded to the teaching of Arius by affirming the full equality and co-eternity of the Son with the Father. It amended an existing creed which had inserted the word homoousios, one in being with or consubstantial with. Now, we know in our church liturgy they changed the word, the translation of the word homoousios to from one in being with to consubstantial with, and people in the pews scratch their heads because they don't know what that means. It means one in being with. Why did they change it? But anyway, they did. So, but that's what the word they was used. That the Son is consubstantial with or one in being with the Father. The Son is God in the very sense that the Father is God. The Son is not God in some secondary or diminished sense. So this became the first installment of the Nicene Creed, which was completed at the First Council of Constantinople about 60 years later. And it remains the creed that is common to Eastern and Western Christians. Well, the council did not fully resolve the crisis. There was ongoing debate about what the term homoousios meant, and Arian Christianity survived for several more centuries. The great defender of Nicaea was Athanasius, the Patriarch of Alexandria, who argued from salvation reasoning. Athanasius asserted that the salvation that Jesus brings means more than just having your sins forgiven. It's more than a juridical or legal sense. It means participating in the very life of God. They use the word divinization. We still hear it, or sometimes hear it at Mass, preparation of the gifts, when the priest says, by the mixing of the mystery of this water and wine, may we come to share in the divinity of Christ, who humbled himself to share in our humanity. That's the theology of divinization. It's dear to the Greek Eastern churches. So that they talked about the marvelous exchange, that God came to share our humanity so that we could share in the life of God. Well, Athanasius said, if that's the salvation that Jesus brings, you can't give what you don't have. Jesus must have been truly divine if he gives us a share in the divine life. That was the way Athanasius argued to defend what Nicaea had said about Jesus. The Council of Chalcedon met in 451 in the wake of a series of Christological debates. Debates that involved bishops and theologians of rival theological schools in Alexandria and Antioch. They didn't always like each other. It was like Notre Dame playing Boston College in football. Alexandria and Antioch didn't get along too well. These debates revolved around how to speak of the relationship between the divine and human natures in Christ, along with how to affirm the unity of his person. The immediate context for the debate was a teaching that's usually called monophysitism, one naturism, suggesting the notion that Jesus, the divine nature, absorbed the human nature. So here the true humanity of Jesus was put in question, which was a recurring tendency in the early church, to put the true humanity of Jesus in question. The council reaffirmed the Nicene Creed and published its own Christological statement. This most famous Christological teaching represents an attempt to affirm the unity of the person of Jesus, while also affirming the completeness of his human and divine natures in the one person. It speaks of the Lord Jesus Christ as consubstantial with the Father as regards his divinity and consubstantial with us as regards his humanity. So there's this deliberate effort by the council to produce a balanced formulation in the wake of controversies that led up to Chalcedon. The council's teaching does not really provide a Christology in itself. It's like going to a baseball park. It gives the foul lines within which the game can be played. That's what the Council of Chalcedon gives, the parameters within which Christology that's seen as orthodox can be articulated. Most scholars today would argue that even though they may argue differently than Chalcedon, it remains a normative statement for them. And finally, quickly, four developments in modern Christology. You've been very patient here, may be running through this, that have taken place in the last 75 years or so. Let me get the screen up here. Okay. The first is the recovery of Jesus' true humanity. The Jesuit theologian Karl Rahner is an important figure, though not the only figure. Rahner wrote a seminal essay for a volume that appeared in 1951. 1951 was the 1500th anniversary of the Council of Chalcedon. Now, most people in the pews in 1951 were more interested in who won the World Series in 1951 than in the 1500th anniversary of Chalcedon, but theologians get excited about these things. So there was this collection of essays written by great theologians, including Rahner. And Rahner titled this article in German as Chalcedon, End or Beginning? Chalcedon, End or Beginning? He wanted to argue that Chalcedon did not put an end to Christological reflection, even though its teaching remains normative. Rahner made several key points, and one of them was the need to reaffirm Jesus' true humanity. He was convinced that much of Catholic Christology of his day, including the way that normal people in the pews taught about Jesus, was tinged with monophysitism. Put crudely, the idea that Jesus is God in human disguise. Jesus is God wearing a human costume. Rahner insisted that if Jesus is the true mediator between God and humanity, he must be truly human. He must have lived our life and died our death. Rahner stressed that precisely because in Jesus a human nature was assumed by the divine, Jesus' humanity must be truly real and full. This is because closeness to God and genuine human autonomy increase in direct, not in inverse proportion. In other words, when the divine draws close, the human is not nullified or abbreviated or overwhelmed. It's brought to fulfillment. It's brought to perfection. So if we say that in Jesus you have the closest possible union of divinity and humanity, his humanity must be complete, full. He must be more human than you and I, because the divine has drawn infinitely close in his case. The second movement has been the development of liberationist Christology. Starting in Latin America, versions of liberationist theology have been articulated in many different places and cultures now. Peruvian theologian Gustavo Gutierrez is often spoken of as the founder of liberation theology. Gutierrez was sent as a young man to study in some of the best schools in Europe. But when he returned to teach at the university in Lima and work in a pastoral center in a very poor area of Lima, came to believe that the method of theologizing in which he was trained would not work there, would not work in the context of massive poverty and exploitation. So he published his book, A Theology of Liberation, in 1971 in Spanish. Gutierrez's Christology focuses on God's solidarity with the poor and the oppressed. He draws on the Exodus motif in the Bible to speak of God and Christ as liberator. He highlights Jesus' earthly ministry on behalf of the poor, in which Jesus reached out to those on the margins. And he describes the incarnation in a very intriguing way. Listen to this. He says, describes it as an incarnation into littleness and service in the midst of the overbearing power exercised by the mighty of the world, an eruption that smells of the stable. An incarnation into littleness and service in the midst of the overbearing power exercised by the mighty of the world, an eruption that smells of the stable. That's the incarnation. There have been some tensions between the Vatican and liberation theology, but their work has influenced the Catholic Church in articulating especially the principle of the preferential option for the poor. A third development in Christology has been the influence of feminist theology. In this country, in its articulation among white women, as well as Latina or Mujerista theologians, and African-American or womanist theologians. Foremost Catholic feminist theologian in the U.S. is Elizabeth Johnson. She draws on the wisdom literature of the Old Testament, which speaks of God in feminine gendered language as Sophia in Greek. She names Jesus as the prophet and child of Sophia, who in his public ministry announces that God is the God of all-inclusive love, who wills the wholeness and humanity of everyone, especially the poor and the heavy burdened. Johnson highlights Jesus' life-giving interactions with women in his ministry. Wary of the classical notion of Jesus paying the debt of sin through his death, she envisions his death as the result of his ministry, that Jesus threatened the status quo in the political and religious status quo, and that's why he was killed. She interprets Jesus' resurrection as the action of the Spirit of God, who seals Jesus in new, unimaginable life as pledge of a future life for all the violated and the dead. And finally, the fourth development in modern Christology is to mention is the rise of ecological Christology, or Christology of those who are ecologically minded, we might say. The work of a number of theologians to foster dialogue between theology and science has been crucial here. Some of these thinkers have been influenced by the great Jesuit 20th century Jesuit theologian and paleontologist Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. The work of Passionist priest Thomas Berry has also been a factor here. One Christological concept that has gained currency is that of deep incarnation. Deep incarnation, first suggested by a Lutheran theologian from Denmark, named Niels Gregersen. Gregersen focuses on that famous verse, John 1:14, that I already talked about, and the word became flesh. He knows that the word there is not human in Greek, it's flesh, sarx in Greek. He's not denying the fact that Jesus was human, that the word became human in Jesus, but the argument is that the use of sarx there, flesh, connects God not only with the human flesh of Jesus, but with all flesh, with all that's finite and perishable, with the matter that extends throughout the universe. In Gregersen's words, deep incarnation means that God became flesh for the purpose of reconciling humanity and the world so intensely together that there can be a future also for a material world characterized by decomposition, frailty, and suffering. It's a reminder that the Christian notion of salvation is not salvation from the world, salvation of the world, that in some mysterious way, the universe will be transformed. And Gregersen argues that this notion of the word becoming flesh connects God directly with all that's matter throughout the universe, including dark matter, I guess. Well, friends, as with all the presentations in this series, a lot more could be said. This is very inadequate, but I just tried to paint the landscape with some very broad strokes. I've included a couple of questions for discussion during the next few minutes. What image or title for Jesus is most significant for you? Is there a scene or a story in the Gospels that has particularly spoken to you about the identity of Jesus? What does it say to you? So I can stop the share now, David. Should I?
Sure.
Okay. Where did that go? Spent half my life looking for the cursor. Okay.
All right. Thank you. That was a quick overview. I could have sat through about another 15 of those sessions as you would have gone deeper into some of those issues. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll have take an opportunity for a quick break, and then we'll come back. We'll have some small group time that you can share within small groups for about 10 minutes, and then we'll come back together and finish our time together in a large group. The questions that Robin has put, I'm putting them here in the chat. Go ahead and open those up so that when you move into your small groups, you'll have them there on your screen. Okay? Let's take a 5-minute break, and then we'll come back together and we'll do some small group work. Thanks. See you in 5 minutes.
Okay.
We all come back together again. So as we do, just a quick question. Was there anything that you talked about in your groups that you want to bring back to Robin? Anything you want clarification on, or anything that struck you particularly that you've never heard before that you just needed to affirm what you heard? Anything in your groups at all that you want to bring back to our presenter tonight?
Well, the group that I was listening to, this man spoke about he goes for walks and imagines himself walking with Jesus and talking to him and having a dialogue with him. And I thought that was really a wonderful example, you know, of how we can spend our time when we're not in church and meditating, to spend time with Jesus, and talking to him. I thought it was a good analysis.
Mm-hmm. That's a form of prayer in itself.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for kicking that off. Any other thoughts?
I enjoyed really understanding again every time, getting deeper. But the four ways of the background of the Gospels, and it just a little different nuance that I didn't know, that which communities they were addressed to, and some of the challenges each of those communities, which will lead me to want to dig deeper on that. So I thanks for opening that, my eyes to that, and being able to come and again peel that onion back a little further for better understanding of the four Gospels and how they relate to the communities they were.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, I thought that was excellent, and how you pointed out the differences between the four of them and their interpretation of it. You know, we never really, when we were in school, we didn't study the Bible in depth. So it was very interesting to have that.
Well, Don's not here tonight, but I'll do a little plug for him anyway. He wrote a book several years ago called Jesus, A Gospel Portrait. And the book is basically four different images or portraits. If you were to have an artist paint a portrait of somebody, of how Mark, Luke, Matthew, and John portray him. So the book is called Jesus, A Gospel Portrait by Don Sr., if you want to read more on that.
Jesus, the what portrait?
A gospel portrait.
A gospel portrait. All right. Thank you.
It's a very fine book.
I like when Robin talked about the different ways of dying with Jesus. I never thought about that before, and betrayal, how each gospel portrayed his death a little differently. That I really like.
Yes,
that.
Yeah, image. That was interesting. Very interesting.
Robin, you did a fantastic job in such a short time. Thank you so much for all your.
You're welcome. Yeah, that is, you know, for us passionists, we there's more than one way to preach the passion, more than one way to reflect upon it. There, I've often wanted to write an article, a book called Models of the Passion, how the way the passion is presented in different ways by different people. But those diverse portraits in the Gospels, mm-hmm. we only had one, we'd be less rich. Mm-hmm. We have the four.
Is it true that John's gospel was written 30 years later? Do you think that affected his interpretation?
Most scholars think that John's gospel was written in the 90s and the letters of John after that around 100. So it would have been about 60 years after Jesus lived and died.
Mm-hmm. So usually the first ones would be more accurate.
Not necessarily.
No. When it's fresh in your mind, don't think.
On some things, scholars think that John's gospel is more accurate. For example, Jesus makes several trips to Jerusalem and the temple, not just one, as in Mark and Matthew and Luke. Some scholars think that's probably more accurate with regard to Jesus' life and ministry.
I'd say.
Robin, I want to ask you, please, is your book about the face or faces of Jesus, I've forgotten the exact wording of the title, is it still available? Can I go somewhere to buy it?
It's on Amazon. Yeah, it's only a year and a half old.
Oh, excellent. Good.
Yeah. Actually came from a retreat I gave once.
Great. And the exact title again is?
Gazing on His Face.
Good. Thank you.
Thanks, Kevin.
I think the parable about the two disciples with Jesus on the road to Emmaus was quite interesting. He did what Robin did. He explained the prophecies in the Old Testament, and he was kind of scolding them and chiding them as he did it, you know. But,
and they recognize him in the breaking of the bread.
That's right.
Favorite. Yep.
Was there anything in there that I missed that I should have said that is on your mind that I wasn't treated?
Like I would know.
No, I don't think so.
Well, I'll throw something out. What's inspired maybe 25, 30 years ago the reinsurgence of the quest of the historical Jesus?
Well, this is the third quest of the historical Jesus, actually. It's happened a couple of other times in the first in the turn of the century and 20th century, and then more in the 60s and 70s. Again, it's the idea that you can't separate or disjoin Jesus and the Christ. And what we believe about Christ must be rooted in Jesus and the real historical figure. You know, Christians talk about the scandal of particularity, our belief that the transcendent God has been encountered in an unsurpassable way in this one Jesus who lived in a finite time, in a finite place, in a village hardly anyone ever heard of, or a finite amount of time, the scandal of particularity. So it's a way of saying that even though we know that the Gospels were written as faith documents, they weren't written as autobiographies in our sense of the term biographies, in our sense of the term biography, that they have to be rooted in the historical Jesus. And how do you sift through the layers of the Gospel to recover that? John Meyer, who teaches at Notre Dame, is the most famous exponent of the third quest for the historical Jesus. If you're interested in paying a few dollars for the new edition of Jerome Biblical Commentary, which Don Sr. is one of the editors of, John Meyer has an essay in there called The Historical Jesus. The historical Jesus is always a construct because scholars have to sift through the layers and they accept some things and don't accept other things. So it's never the actual Jesus you're getting. It's a construct from scholars. And it can't be the ultimate basis of our faith because that construct differs with new scholars. But it is important to keep in touch with what Jesus was actually doing and his real historical context and his actions as the basis for what we believe about him. There have been various attempts, as I said, to disjoin Jesus and the Christ. And some German scholars had done that in the 18th and 19th centuries. So it's a way of saying that Christianity is not a religion of ideas. It's a religion based in a person. Joseph Ratzinger often says that Christianity is about an encounter with a person. It's a long answer, probably a winding answer, David, to a simple question.
Thank you.
Robin, may I tell you what I love that you did? The older I get, the less I know. And thank you for filling in some pieces of history that I didn't have. That was very rich for me. But I love the way you framed the questions, that we get to be, in some ways, an author of our own book in the good news. When you framed the question of what's the image that spoke to you, that really took me from the historical mind, the intellect, you know, which I deeply appreciate, down to the heart level. How do I describe Jesus? How do I live? In my small breakout group, I said that the title I would give him, my image, is the other. My deepening of my faith and my journey is when I see the Christ in other than I. That's the image that I strive for, try to live by. And I thought it was so done, the way you gave us a good grounding in history and understanding, but then you brought it back to us because it is our journey, isn't it? That's to me something the Passionists do very well. And I thank you for that gift. It was both gift and grace. So thank you.
Thank you, Mary. You know, our image of Jesus is like a mosaic with all the little pieces, the tesserae drawn from many different places, sometimes that are even unconscious. I had an experience in this when I was doing doctoral studies. I grew up in Richmond, Virginia, at St. Paul's Catholic Church. And one of the main entrances to the church, we passed a side altar that had a statue of the Sacred Heart, just always there. You knew it was there and you passed it. Sometimes people prayed at it. I didn't think too much about it. Later on, when I was doing doctoral studies, I was writing a dissertation on Karl Rahner's theology. And he wrote some important essays on devotion to the Sacred Heart. As profound as his theology was, he had this interest in the Sacred Heart of Jesus. And I found myself drawn to them. I read them all. And then I made the connection. This must have something to do with growing up and passing that statue of the Sacred Heart at St. Paul's Church in Richmond, Virginia, that this was triggered in me somehow. There's some connection here. I think that's true for most of us with our image of Christ, that we have these images made up of these little pieces drawn from different places. And often they act on us almost unconsciously. We have to make the connection.
What a beautiful example. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Robin. We are out of time. Robin, I want to thank you so much for being with us tonight and kicking us off on this new 2022-2023 e-learnings time. It was a good evening. Got us thinking and reflecting. And I don't know about you, but everybody else, I'm kind of looking forward to some more of this as we go forward.